Welcome to another episode of the Wheelchair Roundtable, where real people share real stories. Coming to you from the Town Place Suites by Marriott McAllen Edinburgh Studio, right here in the heart of the Rio Grande Valley, the front line and the gateway of the USA. Rico ATP, and riding with me is the one and only Quad Father.
They see me rolling.
We're just an ATP in a quad, a microphone, a mission, and a whole lot of passion. This podcast is about real people, real stories, and real power, spotlighting life after injury, adaptive technology, and the voices reshaping what it means to roll forward. Crushing stigmas one episode at a time. So buckle up, because at this roundtable, we're not just talking, we're building a movement. Danny, how are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, man. It's, what's today, Tuesday?
Tuesday, yes. It's almost Christmas. Next Thursday, right?
Yep.
Yeah. We have one more. Thursday's the last day for the students, but we finish on Friday. I think we get 3 weeks off or something like that. I don't know.
So how were the finals?
Fine. Oh, man, I killed my students last week. We had three exams last week. I gave them three exams last week. So.
What? Same topic or different topic?
It was their exam four, their final exam, and their lab exam. Similar topics, but very different things on them. My kids, they were troopers this semester. I mean, it's a college class. They have to be one little hard on them. But now if they can get through here, next semester will be a lot easier.
Really?
Yeah.
That's awesome. And how much have you changed as far as your teaching experience? And how long have you been teaching now?
This will be 10 years in February.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. I got the little email from the school saying, it's your 10-year, what gift do you want? It's like a Yeti and or a backpack or like this windbreaker. I went with a windbreaker, but...
You should tell them to get you a titanium rigid frame,
yeah,
bro.
Big old...
With some freaking color spinners.
But no, it's good. It's changed because I've changed different subjects. When I first started, I hadn't finished my master's yet. So I was a CTE teacher. I taught food science at the beginning. And then at some point, about my third year, they asked me if I wanted to do robotics as well. So I was like, sure, why not? Something new. So I had food science, robotics, and then I started doing some AP biology stuff. And then around halfway, like in 2020, is when I finished my master's. And since then, I've been doing the college class for the high school students that are working under associates. So it's changed in the sense that I've done different subjects, and it's a very different world between those things. So it you know, what I teach and how I teach has been very different. Because one of them, it's from the college, so I have to, you know, they have their own things that are required as the high school, and I have like two bosses almost. Yeah, it's a trip, but I enjoy it, so it's nothing too bad, but you know.
Well, don't forget to mention you also coach.
Yeah, well, I just started the girls' flag football club here in the, well, I think we're the first ones to do it for any high school. We started that last year, so.
Really?
Yeah, we're going to start again in January. We already had some fundraisers, so yeah.
I am so proud of you, Danny. Yeah, I am so proud of you. Have you finished your Christmas shopping?
No, I'm waiting for some stuff to arrive. Christmas shopping is always tough for anybody, but in a chair, that's why one thing I've learned to do is more online shopping. If I do have to go somewhere, it is like here at the mall, I try to stay away from the mall if possible. But if I do have to go to the mall, it's just hit it, quit it, right? You just go in and go out what you're going to do. And you know, you have your spot that you're going to go and just go do that. Because if I kind of meander, there's so many people. It's like, that's when the one time you wish you had like a bumper on your wheelchair just to start ramming people out of the way. They don't see you. A lot of people don't see you. And
that's true.
One thing that's interesting about wheelchairs, and I'm sure some of our guests can tell you, it's hard to go slow in a wheelchair.
Really?
It's harder than you think because we have our pace and people walk at their pace. And
wow,
in, you know, when you're in a wheelchair, it's just a little faster. It's kind of hard to slow down.
Well, especially with you, you're a quad.
Yeah, so it's just, you know, it's one of those things where you have to find your rhythm and just kind of zigzag in and out of people. But, you know, for the most part, people, you know, they see you come in, they like kind of move out of the way. But if you're behind people, it's, you know, they can't see you. So you just kind of go around them. And I tend to roll against the grain. So people are coming towards me as opposed for me behind them. That's one thing that I do a lot of. But, and then whenever I'm shopping, like if I can't reach things, people are usually pretty helpful and they'll just get stuff for me.
Yeah.
But yeah, mostly it's online and whatever I can do online as much as possible, I'll do.
Is it possible for you to go shopping by yourself?
I do. I've done it. Most, like, let's say I'm going somewhere like Walmart, for example, right? Or HEB here, right? Food groceries.
All right, take me to HEB.
I'm going to HEB. So I get there, I get one of those little, the little baskets. Because I'm not going to get, I've never been to HEB or Walmart and get a basket, like a cart full of groceries. That, if I'm going to do that, I'm just going to Instacart it to the house. But let's say I need some stuff for school, for example. I get my little cart, my little basket, and all places will have a person that they can assign to you. Just an employee that will come around and help you and get your groceries. So there's been many instances where I'll go to Walmart or HEB and I'll ask them, hey, do you have somebody that can assist me in shopping? That's something that all stores have. They should have by law. And yeah, and they'll have somebody and they'll get them. And then that person just, what do you need? And they'll grab it for you. They'll load it for you.
So they assist you the whole time?
Yeah, the whole time.
Like whenever, loading into your vehicle and stuff like that?
Yeah, exactly.
I had no idea, bro.
Yeah. So it's not, I mean, most of the time if I go, it's, you know, I'm going to like three or four things. I can just put the basket on my lap and do it myself. Right. If there's the one thing that's way up there, I'll only ask for help from somebody if I know it's going to be a lot of stuff.
So I guess you can't go through self-checkout, can you?
I mean, so whenever I'm by myself and I do self-checkout, I just tell the person that's there, hey, I need some assistance.
True.
And they'll help me real quick. There's always a way. A lot of people kind of overthink it. But yeah, that's why they're there to help. It's the same like for gas, right? I can't pump my own gas. As far as I know, by law, there's supposed to be two people at a gas station. That way, if anybody ever needs help outside of the gas station, they will send somebody outside and pump the gas for me.
I didn't think about all this stuff, dude.
Yeah, it's just little things like that.
The little things, huh? Let me ask you this. So at what point were you okay asking for help?
I learned asking for help was something I needed to do when I was at Craig Hospital. They, you know, never be afraid to help. And they, you know, they were always there. And I just got used to saying, hey, will you grab this? The OTs were always tough on you. It's like, let's see if you can do it yourself first. That's what an OT like does, an OT. Right? Or a PT, right? That's what they do. Yeah. But eventually it's like, okay, you know, if I can't do something, it's going to be okay. I think one thing people always, they're afraid to ask us if we need help, right? Like if I'm out there.
I can see that.
But, you know, and most of the times I'll be like, no, I usually get it. I've got it. But if I need help, I'll say yes, right? But never stop asking. I mean, but for me asking for help, I think it came pretty quickly because there's just stuff that I can't physically do, right? No matter how much, you know, I want to try to do it myself, it just, you know. I mean, usually sometimes I've, you know, there's been times, can't think of a thing right now, but like, okay, like a perfect example, right? I'm at the school now. Papers fall. Picking up paper was always tough for me, right? I don't have the use of my fingers, right? So how do I do it? And the first couple of years, I just asked my students to pick it up, right? Can you? And the students are always like, yeah, I got you, sir. But as time has passed, I figured, oh, you know what? I try this so I can use my chair and slide it up against my chair. Like there's different ways that I figured out.
Techniques?
Yeah, different techniques. I mean, if I'm patient, if a coin is on the floor, that's probably the hardest thing for me to pick up. I can do it.
Wow.
It takes me a minute or two, but
really?
At a certain point, I just get frustrated. It's like, no. Like, somebody will see me struggling.
Uh-huh.
I got this. It's like, no, I'm going to do this now. Because it's just like, I just wasted a whole minute on just picking up a penny when I could have just said, yeah, just come help me. But sometimes it's just like, I'm just stubborn and just simple things like that. But, you know.
So to get back real quick to the HEB, I don't want to get too far off on this. But how long does it take you, Daniel? By the time you pull in, by the time you get down, you do your thing. And let's say you're going in there for four or five items.
Okay, so getting there, parking about a minute out, right, because of my vehicle. So about 2 minutes, you know, getting out of my vehicle and making sure it's locked, getting in there, picking up the cart. The thing that might take a bit is if I do need help, just them getting somebody for me, right? Like it'll take, they have to get somebody from the back. But let's say it's just me, right? Uh-huh. I just get a little basket from the front. I kind of know where everything's at if it's something that I've gotten before. Maybe 10 minutes and I'm out of there, right? And then again, the part that'll take a little bit longer is checkout. Like hopefully somebody's there to help me. And if not, I'll just wait a bit. And then they check out for me. And then a lot of times, if they're helping me with that, then they'll say, hey, can I take this to your vehicle? And I'm just like, yeah, because I've done it enough to where I've put stuff on my lap, and then it slides because those plastic bags just slide. So now it's just like, you mind taking it for me outside real quick? And they'll do it. So that's an automatic now. I don't even put stuff on my lap anymore. I used to, unless it's like one item and I know it's not going to slide. Plastic bags are slippery, so I'll just...
On your truck, you have the... What kind of lift do you have on there? I know it's an assist...
I don't know what it was... You know what? Where are my keys? I have it on my keys. It's what was the company called? A mobility ATC, I think that's what it was called. It's not a company anymore, but yeah, just the door goes out 3 feet, like straight out, and then it drops me. But so that's why it takes a minute out because it's two motors.
But where is your gas cap? Is it on your driver's side?
It's on the driver's side, yeah.
So how the hell do you put gas?
Well, the gas pump is behind, so it's not in the way.
So you creep up and then come down.
Yeah, creep up, come down. I have never attempted to pump my own gas yet.
Okay, that was what I was wondering.
Okay,
so when you get out, you dock, you go by the gas pump, you call the attendant. Oh, you go in.
I'll just go inside. Oh, okay. I know there's a button there, but buttons never work.
Bro, you can't even get your freaking receipt out of a gas pump.
Yeah. No, I'd rather just go in there and they can see me and they're like, oh, you know what? Because when you're pushing the button, they can't see you and they don't see the wheelchair. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So if I go inside, it's like, oh, okay. Like he, you know, there's more urgency, I think, when I go inside and they actually see me as to a post where like they're just hearing somebody on a speaker and just, I need help.
Well, we got somebody who's a pretty badass on the show today. And, you know, luckily for us, he brought his friend who's also a PT. Go ahead and introduce Tyler to us, Dan.
All right. So today's guest is Tyler Keller. And before injury, Tyler was an all-around athlete competing in nearly every high school sport and was raised on a small farm in Michigan in a family where rodeo wasn't just a sport, it was a way of life. Both of his parents were professional rodeo riders. His sister competed at a high level, and Tyler followed that path, earning a rodeo scholarship to Lamar Community College in Colorado, where he placed top three at several national rodeo competitions. In February of 2015, Tyler's life changed in an instant. While driving to school, which at that point was going to be Colorado Mesa University, he lost control of his vehicle at Douglas Pass near Grand Junction, went through a guardrail, and fell over 180 feet. Surviving only because his vehicle landed on a ledge instead of dropping nearly 2,000 feet. After being trapped for hours, Tyler was rescued and rushed to St. Mary's Hospital, where he underwent emergency surgery and was diagnosed with a T4, T5 complete spinal cord injury. What followed was not just recovery, but reinvention. From intense rehab at Craig Hospital to redefining strength, independence, and purpose, Tyler rebuilt his life, returning to competitive sport, competing, and becoming a national-level wheelchair basketball athlete with the Detroit Pistons wheelchair basketball team, competing in adaptive shooting, and stepping into entrepreneurship. Tyler's story isn't just about surviving an accident. It's about grit, identity in the process, and finding purpose after everything changes. We're honored to have him at the round table today.
All right. Hell yeah. Welcome to the show, Tyler. How are you, man?
I'm good, guys. Thank you for having me.
Oh, man. Thanks for coming on. You got an amazing story. Yesterday, we were in for a treat yesterday in our pre-show call, and I'm super pumped about this episode. And then before we got on, we were kind of having like a pre-show episode because he was telling us about something like Neuralink kind of stuff. And we could have gone off on that. So we don't know what Tyler's going to bring to the show today, but we are super excited.
It's going to be a fun one.
And Joe, how are you doing, my friend?
I am doing well today. How are you guys doing?
We're good. We're really enjoying
cooler weather.
You know, here in the Rio Grande Valley, we average like, 108, 110, 110 degrees in the summer.
I'm sure you all are freezing over there right now. It's 70 degrees outside.
What's the temperature over there?
It was down to 6 a couple
just
days
six.
Ago.
Like, you know, just 6. Just,
yeah, I have like 3 inches of ice on my driveway right now that I got to figure out how to get rid of.
You're going to have to tell us how you get around in a wheelchair with ice because that's an interesting
one. Dude, that is a great question. Okay. Well, Tyler, let's just go ahead and we want to hear your story.
Yeah. So I am 30 years old. I am a T4, T5 complete paraplegic. I got injured in a, traumatic car accident. I had a slight traumatic brain injury as well. I did my inpatient / outpatient finishing up at Craig Hospital. So I have a good foundation for, I guess, some of my knowledge that I have when it comes to my injury and who taught me. And yeah, a college athlete.
Amazing. So let me ask you this, Tyler. Before the accident, who were you, man?
Before my accident, I was just any old high school kid. I depended on my athletics. That's what pushed me through high school. I ended up finding the passion for welding. My school offered a really cool vocational program, so I was able to leave halfway through the day and go to another school that offered a welding shop, and I was able to learn that craft from my junior and senior year, and that was just an amazing opportunity that really created a whole spark for a craft that I never knew existed at the time. That was a big thing, and I continued to do that through high school.
How did being raised on a small farm in Michigan shape your work ethic and mindset?
Well, I mean, my dad never accepted can't as an excuse for anything. So anytime you said, I can't do something, he would say can't isn't a word. And growing up, as a kid, you can always find a reason to say, I can't this or, that. And my dad always just took it as an excuse and pushed us in different ways to help us figure it out. It wasn't just unrelenting and no mercy. My dad had a good head on his shoulders and used it in moments where he knew we could learn from. At the time, us kids saw it as frustrating and, this is annoying. Yeah. But looking back at it, I'm very grateful for that because it did put kind of like a different thought process in my head of trying to figure things out when normally, I guess, most people might give up, because the second you say, I can't, you already told yourself you're not going to be able to. So why try, right?
I like that. And both your parents were professional rodeo riders, yeah,
correct? They both rodeoed professionally. My mom kind of did a little bit of everything. She barrel raced and roped calves and stuff. And then my dad was a calf roper, and he rode saddle bronc for a little bit.
What'd they meet?
My dad grew up in Milford, and he was a first-generation cowboy, kind of just got into it on his own. And then my mom grew up in Southgate, Michigan, which is kind of like downriver, down by the Ford factories and all that kind of stuff. And they ended up meeting up at a rodeo, and the rest is history.
What was it like growing up with a rodeo family? Because your sisters also competed professionally, right?
Yeah, yeah. And a couple of them still do. And then my third sister, she trains horses professionally, and they raise a bunch of cows out in Nebraska. So it was definitely unique because I'm in an interesting spot here in Michigan. You know, it's not, rodeo isn't very common up here. So it was kind of like a bridge between city kids, and then I'm outside of the city, so then suburb kids, and then going to rodeos and everything, and a bridge of just people from down south and more country. So I felt like growing up, I had a very diverse culture. And then as far as even just my family, they were just down-home, genuine people. They got up, they took care of their chores, they went to school, did their best to get good grades, and came home and took care of their horses and trained their horses, because your horses are athletes too. And you just got to keep training yourself and training your horse. And it's just a cycle. You know, that's one of those things. Rodeo is more of a lifestyle than just a hobby. You know, you got to be committed all the way.
And shout out to your parents, man. Good job.
Yeah, they held it together for sure.
Did you always see rodeo as part of your future? Did you know?
No, not at all, actually. When I grew up, you know, I was the only boy, and my sisters were very heavy into that. And I can't say I never really got along with my sisters, but, you know, they were all in their friends, and then I had my boys then, and that was the thing. I played sports, and they were into horses a lot more. So I was more into four-wheelers and sports when I was younger, and then they were all 2 years older. But, you know, there's a seven-year from my oldest sister down to my age. So they were a little older and competing on horses when maybe I wasn't as interested or a little too young for it. And I liked competing in sports at the time.
So at what point did you decide, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and pursue rodeo as my high school sport? And eventually you got a scholarship.
Yeah, actually there was an opportunity. It's called Michigan High School Rodeo, but they actually have a juniors division as well. And so they have like some modified rodeo events. And so they offer it from 6th grade to 8th grade are the juniors. And then 9 to 12 are the high school rodeo, the seniors. And you can compete in both divisions. And my sisters already had the horses, and my sisters were already going to these events at the time. And I was already a competitive and athletic person, and I had ridden and stuff. It just wasn't a super strong passion to where I wanted to ride every day. So when I was young, I played competitive baseball. I went to Cooperstown, you know, as, what was that, 12-year-old? And so that was a really cool experience. So I played a lot of competitive high-level sports as a young kid. And then as I grew out of that and expanded into rodeo, that kind of just took over, because it was a whole new world, and it challenged you in every way. You had to learn to be a horseman even better than anything I knew before. Anything I thought horse riding was, being a horseman is, you know, you have to have a whole nother grasp on riding your horse, roping, handling the cows, and then bringing athleticism into it. It pushed all of my skills and abilities to the limits and forced me to evolve.
So this was through the National High School Rodeo Association, right? And that's the largest youth rodeo organization in the world?
I believe so, yes.
Is it a common thing for most of the schools to have that program, or in your area, or is this kind of scattered?
It's not set up like traditional schools. Like, you have sports teams like football, and like a lot of schools even have equestrian teams, and the equestrian teams are through the school, right? This is, as long as you're enrolled and you're passing your classes, like you still have to submit your report cards and everything. So like they still verify your enrollment in school and the classes you're taking, and that you're getting adequate grades and that kind of stuff as well. So it's kind of like any other high school sport, but it's not directly, the team isn't directly affiliated with the high school, because there's only, you know, especially here in Michigan, you might have 2 to 3 kids that are rodeoing in one school, or you might have a handful in one and none in the other. So it would make it really hard for even like teams to necessarily compete. You know, everybody goes to the same rodeo on the same weekend. So it doesn't necessarily need to be directly affiliated with the high school, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So like, no, it's not like a UIL thing where it's a team thing. It's outside, but you have to be going to school for it. But
that organization is the one that provides the scholarships, I think so.
Yeah. I mean, they offer all sorts of scholarships. So like when you pay your entry fees throughout the seasons, that money goes into like your scholarship fund. And so at the end, when you graduate, that money can come back. And then they also multiple other scholarship opportunities. So like when I was in high school, I interviewed, there was a interview that you had to apply for, and I went in and got the interview and I ended up getting the first prize. And I don't remember how much that was, but I think it was like $2,000 scholarship, but that was an additional scholarship on top of the other stuff. So like there's multiple avenues to, you know, get help and, you know, build throughout the years.
So how do they divide up the winnings, the prizes from these tournaments?
It depends, dividing up the prizes. So in high school rodeo, your entry fees, you're not getting paid in currency. Generally speaking, you get points, and how you do throughout the season then accumulates, and then you have like a year-end award ceremony. So like the first place all around, you'd win a buckle, a saddle, you'd get, like back when I was in high school, my senior year, I won the all-around. And I got an Ariat sponsorship deal. I was on the all-star team at Nationals. So I got like free pair of jeans, a saddle, buckle, multiple shirts, like they a free pair of boots. So like they set you up. And so a lot of people, you know, in the rodeo world, generally you're paying a lot of entry fees and it costs a lot to travel. So you're kind of paying in, you know, it's a way of investing into your kid's future and a sport they like to do and all that kind of stuff. So it can be a little counterintuitive to the rodeo community because you're not getting paid at the rodeos, even if you do well, but it all accumulates. You get chances to go out to Nationals, right? If you qualify and do well, there's sponsorship deals. You meet a lot of cool people. There's so many opportunities. It opens up a lot of doors. So I can't say enough how worth it is. But I guess that would be the downside that a lot of people say.
And this operates in all the U.S. states, Canada, Australia, and Mexico.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually have a mutual connection from Australia because I met him at Nationals. And so he invited me out there anytime I can manage the funds and to get out there. He said he'd have me. So
nice. And the events and competition, you have what, rough stock events like bareback riding, saddlebrook riding, a bull riding, and you also have timed events like tie down roping, team roping, steer wrestling, breakaway roping, and other events are barrel racing, goat tying, and pole bending. Did I leave anything off?
You actually did leave one. That's the Queen's competition.
What's that?
So they're just like with any other, how they do the beauty pageants and everything else, they actually have a queen competition. So all the different girls from school, if they want to do the pageant stuff, right, it's a whole nother event, and it kind of gets left off, but it's actually a pretty big thing. These girls can get a lot of sponsorship opportunities. There's some girls that are in high school rodeo just so that they can do the queen competition. Like, it is actually a fairly recognized pageant thing.
Yeah.
I guess like the homecoming queen we have down here?
Well, no, we have, you know how we have like Miss, we start having those festivals. They have the big one for all the high school students. Yeah, it's very similar to that then, I think, because.
Man, where have I been?
I don't know. You've been away. Well, you were in Houston for a while. But yeah, we don't have the whole rodeo thing, but we do have that pageant. Yeah.
I'll tell you one thing, man. Houston rodeo is off the chain, bro.
Houston rodeo is huge.
I love it. So as far as the competition, is there, like you said, there's a national high school finals rodeo? Is that where, you know, all the winners are made, or is it just only regional competitions?
So, I mean, how it's all set up is through the states. Like the Michigan High School Rodeo Association, they all compete to acquire points throughout the season, however many rodeos that's necessary. And then those points and those qualifiers will go to the year-end finals within their state. And then however they finish at the end of the season, whether they're in the top 3 or the top 5, It depends. Like Texas is a really big state, so it's broken up into regions. So I think Texas is only allowed to bring the number one qualifier from each region, whereas Michigan is allowed to bring, I believe, the top three from each event, right? So there's less participants in Michigan, there's more in Texas, so they have to break it down that way. I think it does break down to even team, but some teams are larger, some teams are smaller because not everybody competes in every single event. So it just depends on the state and the demand. And then as everyone competes in their state, then you go to the National High School Finals. And so the National High School Finals is the kind of committee and everything that oversees that. And there's student roles. So like you can be the national finals student vice president, and then kind of you shadow underneath the actual vice president stuff. So even that applies down to the state level. When I was in the high school rodeo as a junior, I actually was the student vice president. So there were certain roles that I took on underneath the other, you know, different people and that were on the board and directors and everything. And so there were certain roles that I had to take on and help out with. So they do as much to break it down to student vice president and give everybody roles out at nationals. I applied for to be the saddle bronc director. So at every performance throughout the week, I had to be out in the arena and be there with the judge that's judging the rodeo. And if any of the kids had to dispute any of the calls that were made in the arena, they had to come to me first and we had to dispute the rules in the book and then go talk to the judges after that. And so there's a lot of opportunities to grow in all the way from rodeo to pageantry to being a vice president or president of an organization, because you can shadow these people and they really take you under their wings and you can figure some cool stuff out.
It's badass, man. Yeah. I have no idea.
Learn a lot though.
I'm learning quite a bit, man.
What was your event, like your bread and butter? I'm curious, what was like the thing that was your favorite one to do?
I was going to ask you, man, what did you compete in?
My biggest one was calf roping. That was in my backyard. My dad was a big calf roper and my sisters did breakaway roping. So that was always in my backyard and I could rope calves at any time. So that was my bread and butter. But I had a buddy that his dad was a professional steer wrestler. And him and I kind of swapped. He'd come down here and rope calves, and then I'd go up there and we'd steer wrestle. So he'd use calf horses, I'd use his steer wrestling horses, his dad would haze for us, that kind of stuff. And so we kind of tag teamed it. So calf roping's my main one, but steer wrestling was something that I didn't get to do as much as I'd like to, but it definitely was one of my favorites.
What do you aim for, the feet when you're roping?
For steer wrestling or for calf roping?
For calf roping, I think.
Yeah, calf roping, you're roping around the neck and you're actually tied off to the horse. And
that is?
That's the one where a lot of people lose their fingers, don't they?
No, that's team roping.
Okay.
You have to wrap the rope around your saddle horn and people get their fingers trapped in trying to
rush.
Yeah,
that's the one I'm thinking of. Yeah.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Sounds like a gunshot. When somebody's finger gets stuck in a dally and that rope comes tight and it takes it off, it sounds like a gun's going off.
Witness this?
Yeah,
we see it a lot.
Whoa.
People get to rushing and those steers in the open ropings, the steers are really fresh and they're running super fast. And so even some of these guys, they're really, really good ropers, but them steers come around the corner hot and they throw that rope and they know how to rope, so they catch feet and then they gotta rush that dally and they get a finger sucked in there and it comes tight and it happens like you snap your fingers. That's how fast it happens. That's why it sounds like a gun going off, man. It just shatters the bone.
Find the finger, put it on ice, and go to the emergency room.
Yep, that's all you can do. Hope for the best.
Yeah, I mean, I've been to enough. I mean, I didn't grow up around that, but like my family, you know, they did a lot of that. So I grew up around that, and I've heard stories and I've seen some of that. But like, yeah, dude, I could never.
That was one of those things that my dad trained on me like putting the safety back on a rifle when you're done shooting it.
Right.
Like it is built into you how to dally and undally, and that mechanic needs to be muscle memory before you ever try and rope that fast, because the second you get panicked is when your fingers get sucked in. So like my dad was very adamant, because I'm sure my dad rodeoed for years and years, and I've, you know, let's say I got 10 years of experience under my belt. I haven't seen probably a fraction of stuff. My dad grew up way back when it was still kind of the Wild West, you know. he traveled all over, hitchhiked, whatever. You know, the rodeo and travel for that kind of stuff was different.
Okay. Wow. We got to get him on the show. That's some good stories. So all this work, brother, so did you get a full scholarship? What was where you went to? Is it Mesa College first? No.
Lamar.
Yeah, so I ended up getting a full ride scholarship to Lamar Community College in Lamar, Colorado. And I studied welding and was on the rodeo team there. And I competed in calf roping, team roping, steer wrestling, and bull riding when I was out in college. So I was competing for the all-around. I ended up placing in the top three at 4 out of 5 of my first college rodeos in the first semester. You have 5 rodeos a semester. So I was on track to make finals for nationals. And I got another scholarship offer from Northwestern, like Colorado Mesa University. And so I was driving up to there to check that scholarship opportunity out when I broke my back. I got in a car accident, and that's kind of where my story all changed.
So let's talk about that for a second. You go down. I've been in those mountains because I traveled over. That's where I got hurt in Denver. So whenever we were given a trip, we went through those mountains, and there's windy and there's a lot of steep cliffs there. You went down pretty far. You don't remember anything about what happened during that accident, do you?
Yeah, no, I don't remember much. There was a steep corner. There was no guardrail, and it was really dark out. And I could not make the corner, so I tried to turn it as hard as I could, and there was a guardrail on the side, and it ended up impacting my driver's side door, and my back end kind of went off the corner, and then I fell off backwards, so my trunk took the brunt of the impact.
And this is a Douglas Pass, close to Mason
Douglas
County?
Pass in Grand Junction. I think within like an hour or hour and a half of my destination, I was very close, yeah.
Well, and you said it took several hours, or what you were told is it took several hours for somebody to find you?
Yeah, I was, the state trooper told me I was down on the ledge anywhere from like 6 to 8 hours before anybody found me, because my car was cold. Yeah.
Right.
So when you were coming down the highway, you lost control. I guess you were coming in hot, and you saw that guardrail coming. I know yesterday you mentioned to us that you just had a moment of realization that, you know, this is it. Can you take me back to that moment? What was going through your mind?
Yeah, it's one of those things where I've always been a fighter, or, you know, I'm looking for a way to solve the problem. And when I was just sliding, and I finally came to that moment where the back end of my trunk dropped off first. So like the wheels hit. So let's just imagine like the first 2/3 of the car are on the road still, but okay, it was enough to where my car was sliding backwards. Like there was no brakes or anything that were going to get me up, because my front wheels that were off the ground at that point. So I'm sliding backwards, and like the thought to even open the door crossed my mind. But at that point, like then I'm just jumping out of the car off the cliff, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, so like I looked over, remember feeling like, yeah, there's nothing I can do. So I just had a come to Jesus moment, I guess. And I just accepted that, you know, this isn't the way I thought my life was going to end. But from everything I felt in my soul, felt like this was it. You know, I don't know how else to explain it. And so I just grabbed the steering wheel, and I just closed my eyes and laid back. And the next thing I remember, I woke up in the hospital.
I don't think there's a word to describe that emotion.
No, I mean, something like that's going to happen. You just brace yourself, and whatever happens at that point, I guess.
And I think that's the crazy part, though, is like, I don't even think I braced. I truly feel like I just accepted and went limp. Like I have my hands around the wheel, but I think the second I closed my eyes and we're just like, dang, it's over. I don't know. That was the last thing.
And somebody was driving by and just saw the guardrail messed up. And they
called. Yeah, and so that crazy story. So the reason I got found was because a truck driver that was driving through on his morning, on his way out for the day, you know, the guardrail was in good shape. And on his way back, he saw that it got dinged. So he just called the cops and was just like, hey, you know, I don't know if anything's down there, but that guardrail is messed up. So I think you guys need to go check that out. So the state trooper came, and I guess that's a common area where they might ditch cars off. The criminals will go ditch some cars off. They actually, the state trooper had to rappel down the mountain and check to see if anyone was in the car before he could even call for emergency response. So he had to rappel down there, and he said he heard me groaning. I don't remember anything, but he said he heard me groaning when he got close to the car. So he knew that someone was in there, but he still had to rappel down, you know, a few hundred feet to get to me.
This is what, 6 to 8 hours you're just there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's what he said.
They
kind of backed me off the side of the mountain there.
And then getting tools to get you out of the question.
But yeah. So then that was another crazy part. So my car's down there and I had all my welding tools in my trunk, and that my trunk took the impact. So everything was busted open and all my tools were scattered all down the side of the mountain. And the cops actually in the EMS used my welding tools to break my car and chop my car open to get me out, because the jaws of life weren't able to reach that far.
Wow.
That was just a miracle.
Tell us about, you get taken, once they finally get you out of there, you get taken to St. Mary's. I know you said you didn't kind of snap out of it until about a day and a half later.
Yeah. So from that night, I got flown in a helicopter and had my spinal stabilization surgery at St. Mary's. And I think it was about 2 days, a day and a half before I woke up.
And what was that kind of experience like? Kind of, because for me, it was totally different. I was awake for my whole ordeal. I never blacked out. I was aware of what was going on with me the whole time. I'd imagine kind of just, you were in a vehicle just a moment ago, and now you're waking up in a hospital room. Kind of walk us through that.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of spooky. I had no idea what was going on, but I knew that something bad had happened because both my parents were there. And the last I remembered, I was in Colorado, you know, doing whatever I was doing. So it was kind of a surreal moment, and I knew something serious had happened, but I had no idea what yet.
And how long did it finally kind of kick in that something, you know, did they ever tell you exactly what it was that happened there at St. Mary's, or did they try to explain to you what was the situation was like?
Yeah, actually, I mean, it was actually pretty fast after I woke up. I feel like I said hi to my parents, and then probably within the hour, I'd say the doctor came in and kind of asked me if I had an idea what happened, and all the different little questions, trying to probe and see if I had any clue what went on. And honestly, at that time, I was pretty lost. And then he kind of just, like, I guess, tried to break it to me as gently but as real as possible. Just like, are you noticing any different? You know, and like, I at that point, I had kind of observed, like, when my parents said that they were going to go get the doctor, that he needed to tell me something, like, I kind of downplayed it in my own mind, you know, didn't think of anything of it, you know, the doctor going to give me the, you know, come talk to me about something or whatever, you know, I didn't think in too much of it. But, you know, then he comes in and tells me that, you know, I broke my back and they did the best they could to stabilize me and do the things they could. But, you know, there's a good chance that my progression and ability to walk is going to be limited. They said, you know, it's early on, you know, that was within probably 72 hours of me breaking my back. So they were, I guess, as optimistic as one could be. But, you know, when one of my vertebrae was a complete burst fracture, so it wasn't a soft injury by any means.
Tyler, how critical was your mom during your recovery role, early in your recovery?
My mom was my rock, especially early on. She stayed with me in Colorado. I mean, helped me take care of everything as far as medical appointments, staying on time, trying to manage your bowel program, and just everything that goes with it. From St. Mary's, they moved me down to Craig Hospital, and when we were there, they kind of throw you right into a 40-hour work week. You have physical therapy, you have occupational therapy, you have recreational therapy, and then you have your lunches and your mental therapy and all the other things that go along with it that might be a part of your care that might be needed, right? And so she was a critical part of helping, keeping me moving, going to appointments, and just keeping me fed and making sure that all the doctors were taking care of me, had my best interest at heart. Because when you lose hope on yourself, and it's hard to advocate for yourself, and people will just kind of write whatever scripts they want or do whatever they need to do. So it's important to have someone in your corner.
What before you went over to Craig, what were you able to do? Or were they doing any sort of like light therapy with you before you got moved to Craig?
Yeah. A lot of it was just like leg circulation and moving around.
Yeah. Okay.
But they got me in and out of the bed. That's actually another fun story I forgot about. When I was at St. Mary's and I still had my shell on, this was probably, I'd say a week and a half after I broke my back. And there is a traveling nurse there, and he was trying to help me after newly injured. And I think technically there's supposed to be two people there, but he was trying to help me into my chair for the day. And I ended up on the floor. I didn't want anybody. I was like, you know, I'm good. Just get me back in my chair. Let's keep it moving. I want to get out of here. So, you know, whatever's done is done. There's, you know, looking back on it now. But that was one of those things that you gotta look out for yourself. You gotta advocate. And if there's supposed to be two people there, there's definitely a protocol there for a reason. So sometimes you just gotta trust the process.
Hey, Joe, I got a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
So in this situation for Tyler, he's a new injury. What are you, as a goal as a physical therapist, you know, it's a new injury. What do you have limitations of what you can do versus the realistic goals that are set?
I mean, like in that acute stage, I mean, all we can really do is figure out how much he can still do. But if we can keep people moving, you know, stretch, keep blood flow going, get the legs moving a little bit, and just doing everything that we can to keep the body moving in that stage while they're still healing. It's kind of the most we can do. I mean, like in the hospital in that acute setting, a lot of it is more assessment, right? Oh, where do we need to go next? This stuff is going to take some time to really recover from and see what function we get back. At the end of the day, it's just doing what you can.
Let's say you got Danny, who's a C4, C5, versus what we got Tyler with a T4, T5? So I would think your assessment would it be more detailed and higher level? Is like, I can't really do much with the patient.
I mean, the initial assessment is the initial assessment is the whole, like, you go through the whole body, right?
Okay.
I don't want to say more or less detailed one way or the other. I think it's just more, are you looking for muscle twitch and seeing what's still active and what's moving? But a lot of that stuff is done by the neurologist to begin with too. Some of that stuff isn't even done necessarily by the PT and in that acute care setting until you get to more like inpatient care.
Yeah, I would say a lot of the stuff that you asked about would have been done to me when I was at Craig. The notorious, hopefully I'm not speaking out of turn here, but the notorious finger up your butt test. Right.
Yeah,
Pretty much everybody that's had a spinal cord injury has had that done. Right.
And the old noon sign.
Clench your sphincter and you can relax it. You know, that's one of the signs if you're a complete injury or incomplete injury. And so they pick you with prods, or they poke you with little needles, and then they hit you with feathers in different spots to see if you can hit different sensations and stuff. And so they do all that probing early on. And then pretty much by the time I was going to physical therapy and this kind of care, they already have like your baseline and kind of like the things that you can start working on.
I think that's called is it called the Asia test, Joe? Or am I thinking of something else?
Yes. Yeah. Well, the specific test he's talking about is the noon sign, but the whole eval, it's called the Asia exam.
So they get a pin and they tap you in different areas, and let's say they're tapping my leg and I don't know if they're poking me or not, but you have to tell them, does that feel dull or does that feel sharp kind of thing, right? And for me, it was always just, I could feel something there, but it was always dull to me. And then and they just kind of work their way up, right? I'm sure there's a rhyme and reason to where they're poking and prodding right, but and then eventually they do the finger one, see if you can bear down, and then you get rated like from A to E or something like that. What's the high, like the most, the one that's closest to normal, is that A or is that E? Tyler, speaking of Craig, what had you, you're getting told you're going to move over there. What had you heard about the place before you went over there?
Over to Craig?
Yeah. Yeah, had they told you anything about what to expect, or they just kind of said you're moving to a new spot?
No, I mean, they definitely built it up. They told me that, you know, as daunting as a spinal cord injury is, and, you know, it's an uncomfortable situation, but you're fortunate enough to have done it in Colorado because they've dealt with a lot of trauma injuries, right? The mountains are there, and I guess that's a common area where people have spinal cord injuries. So they deal with a lot of spinal cord injuries, a lot of stabilization surgeries. So the people that did my surgeries and that the care I had immediately after was top tier. So that gave me a lot of hope.
I say that I've said that before. I was lucky that I got hurt in Denver. If I would have gotten like hurt here, that's, we didn't have a trauma one center at that point, then I would have had to move to Houston. But yeah, I'm totally lucky that I got hurt where I got hurt. I want to ask Tyler, and this is something you and I kind of share. When you were competing, you were basically almost, if not at the top of your game at that point, you were moving up to the top, right? In the college level. Same thing for me. I had just, before I got injured, I had just won the national championship for flag football, led my team, you know, we're on top of the world, right? And this thing happens to you, right? You go from the top and then now it's like, what am I going to do, right? And you're going to this place, Craig Hospital, which everyone's telling you about. What is your thought process at that point? You're like, okay, I'm going to go to this place. I was just at the top, right? Just a moment ago, I was at the top of my game and now I can't do these things. Now I'm about to get my butt kicked, basically. What are you thinking at that point?
I mean, I've always been as positive as one can be. You know, I've always been an athlete, and when you're negative, nothing ever really comes from negativity. You got to build your teammates up. You got to build yourself up, right? So I was always kind of in that mindset, and I didn't necessarily view my injury as anything different. I definitely understood that it was going to be the hardest thing I ever do. And that's a constant battle every day, right? But, and even like my dad, I told you, can't isn't a word. One of the things that he told me, and, you know, after I got injured when I was still in St. Mary's, was no pain, no gain. You know, this is going to be one of those things, you're going to get out what you put in, and this is going to be painful. You just broke your spine. You know, when I was a kid, I broke my foot, and I've broke finger and different little things here. You know, those things are painful. And in order to rehabilitate them and get back to a good standing, you got to get them moving and you got to push through the pain. So that was like a concept I had understood. And my dad wasn't afraid to give me the reminder. And I think I had enough, I guess, mental fortitude to kind of take that in stride and understand that this is going to suck, but I'm going to do what I can.
And I think you set that exactly the way kind of I do. Like anytime I'm about to do something that is hard, I just tell myself, this is going to suck, right? So now I know it's going to hurt or it's going to be painful. But I think once you tell yourself that, it's kind of important and you just, boom, okay, let's do it now.
I remember you saying that.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know. I do that a lot.
It's expectations, right? Yeah. Like, it's kind of like when you expect to go do something fun or you're expecting something to happen and then the plans change. And you, it's not like necessarily so bad, but like you kind of feel let down or like kind of like this weird feeling. And it's not, nothing, no ill will or anything from anybody or anything, but it's just like you had these expectations built up in your mind of something good or something fun, and then it completely changes and you feel let down. And that's, I feel like the inverse of that.
Right.
There's two perspectives in the same reality.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's just the way you look at things.
What was, tell us about your first impression about Craig Hospital. How was that whole thing going for you there?
My first impression was, listen to the pros, man. I'm in the place where they have everything that you could ever possibly need that's related to the injury, you know? So I tried to just take everything in stride and listen to what they had to tell me, because this is also something new to me. I had no idea of anything. I was not very well versed in anything neuro or anything. All I did was lift weights and train for sports at that time. So this was a whole new world. So I just tried to sit down and listen to the pros. They have classes they sit you down in and presentations so you can understand the body and how the neuro stuff works. Like, they really take their time to try and educate you so that way you can have the best chance at success.
Yeah. they do a really good job of like showing you getting hit from every angle, like what to expect in these situations. And they put you in situations themselves, see what you're going to do and just kind of get you used to it. That way you're not caught off guard when you're out in the real world.
Hey, Tyler, when you're in that mindset, at that point, did you accept that, you know what, I may never walk again?
I think I tried to accept it right away, but I think that's something that kind of constantly evolves. Because I'm constantly learning and adapting the things that I can do and trying things that I couldn't before. So it's just like a constant evolution process.
I think I've mentioned this before. Like sometimes I'm sure you've had this yourself where you kind of plateau. You've been doing this thing and it's just like, this is as good as it gets for now. And then all of a sudden one day you can just do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, you know, you try certain things so many times and then you just... And then one day it's just like, bam, I didn't think I could do this new thing. And
I like that.
Well, yeah. I think it's kind of like, think about it from perspective, like you hyper fixate on something and you try and like force it into reality. But then like after you kind of just like let it be for a second, then you give your body time to kind of like figure it out. And we want to force it to happen right now. But I think kind of planting that seed and letting things progress from there, it seems to, you know, there's an art of patience when it comes to these kinds of things.
Well, I like that.
Patience is huge. It's just, you're so used to the speed that you were at before that everything just slows down, right?
Like, I never thought about that.
It drives me nuts. Yeah. I am a very impatient person.
And it just takes, like in my case, you know, I see the teachers at work, for example, they're flying around getting their copies done. Like I have to plan a whole 30 minutes just to do that, you know, where they can do it in 5 minutes and they're done. Right. I mean, Now I'm just like, hey, I'll grab a kid, come over here and do this for me real quick and they'll do it. But like just little things like that, it's just, I'm not patient. And it's something that, it's been 17 years, but it's still something I need to work on. Yeah.
I think there's times that's definitely worth emphasizing working on your patience and the mastering that skill. But then there's times too, like when you're in a chair and like the world is still happening around you. Like you move slower, but everything is still moving. So you have to do your best to delegate as well. Like if my mom can help me with something or my girlfriend can help me with something, and even though like I could practice my patience and work through this thing and improve from it, but it's going to set me back for 2 more days, right? So
right.
I've really learned, okay, when I have the time to slow down and practice that patience, I do, but then I still have to stay on task and do my day-to-day stuff. So I do my best to delegate and operate within that.
Yeah. You said yesterday that there was a moment at Craig where you just kind of felt like giving up. You had a little moment of, well, I don't know, self-doubt or whatever. Kind of talk to us about that.
Yeah. So like it's probably like my first week or week and a half, and I had been doing the e-stim bike. And I don't know if anybody knows what that is, but it's basically a tablet in front of you. And they put these sticky electrodes on your legs and your abs, or if you're a quad, they'll put them on your arms and stuff, and you'll pedal with your hands and feet. In my case, a paraplegic, I just pedal with my feet. So I was just sitting on that bike every day and then trying to push. And by this point, I had already done it a handful of times. So I felt like I knew what to expect. And every time I tried, I didn't feel like my power increased or anything. So it was very kind of demoralizing to me, because the same effort that I guess I used to put in to lift weights and whatever that would get more out didn't work anymore. You know, I had to kind of tap into other things in order to kind of get stronger. It wasn't just something I could just will and push through anymore. So that was a real demoralizing moment. And my trainer, the physical therapy came up to me and was just like, hey, you know, keep trying to push. And it was at a point for me, I snapped and I just like, I can't, like, it's not working. Every time I push it, the power doesn't improve. Like, quit telling me to push harder or quit telling me to try, because I'm trying and it's not working. Like I was just kind of, that was, I would say my breakdown moment within the first, you know, couple weeks.
What did you do to get through that funk? Like, I'm just always curious what it is that certain people do to get past that, like, that little kind of mental breakdown that you have for a moment, and you're just like, okay, you know what? Let's just keep going. What is it for you that kind of got you? And it's just like, you know what? This happened. Let's go on. What is your thing that you do?
I mean, in that moment, I don't really think I had anything that I knew would work. You know, this was something that was so fresh to me that like I had no solutions. I didn't know what was going to work. I was still in a ton of pain after my injury. So there was really no reprieve. I didn't feel any hope. So at that time, I think the thing I looked to was going home, like definitely getting through here, learning and doing what I can while I'm here. But I just look forward to kind of going home and trying to kind of settle into it on my own without being pushed and prodded. Because in the first like 3 or 4 weeks after I got injured, I probably had 100+ set of hands on me.
Yeah.
So like at that point, I was just like, I want to go home. Like, and I understand they all have jobs too. There's assessments, like we need to figure this stuff out to get you to the best care possible. But I mean, to anybody that I, you know, that's a lot. So I did my best to roll with it. And I think that was one of the things that I kept going. I went to physical therapy 5 days a week. You know, we grinded, but it was a hard push.
Part of your recovery program there, Craig, was rodeo drills, right?
That was actually one thing that kind of made Craig feel like a little home, like, because how many people have a rodeo dummy and ropes at a physical therapy place? You know, it was something so niche that I never would have thought would have happened. So that actually brought me a lot of joy in a hard time. So one of my buddies back from Michigan, who's actually an amputee, he flew out and him and I got for one of my physical therapy sessions, we were able to do some team roping on a little dummy in the rec room. So that was a core memory of my time at Craig, actually.
It's pretty cool. Yeah. When you told me that yesterday, hats off to them, man. That is very creative by the rec therapist.
To have a big room full of toys in that rec therapist.
Is that right?
Yeah. It's just all sorts of stuff. What did I do there? I tie-dyed shirts. We made some really cool, because I was there during the fall, so did pumpkins. That's where I first got on a hand cycle.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was my first experience with a hand cycle, and I was dead tired after. I maybe did like 6 or 7 blocks, and I was dead.
Yeah, that's still impressive, bro.
Dead, yeah. And the girl, the therapist ran with me, and she was like nothing. But yeah, they had all sorts of really cool stuff there.
Tyler, this is a theme pretty much with the show. We've had Jody Bennett was over. He was also a Craig. Danny was a Craig. We had Armando. He was a Craig. So you're the fourth one on the show that, you know, can relate. But they all had a theme. And we talked about this yesterday, where Craig has certain parts or a part of the hospital where you all go out there and it's your time. I know I've heard the parking garage top floor. I've heard bridges. I've heard about the garden. I've heard about, you know, the view of the mountains. Can you relate to that?
Yeah. Yeah. So right at the time where I got injured, it was at the end of February. And so I by the time I got down to Craig, it was the end of March. And so the core part of my recovery was April. And so that's down in Denver. That's when all the flowers are starting to bloom. And they have a kind of little sanctuary garden up in front of the rec room area. And that's where my family and I, we'd all get together. And Denver, growing up in Michigan, you don't really get sun in the winter. So even though it was still maybe a little chilly for Denver climate, it was so enjoyable. We just would go out there and sit in the sun and hang out.
You had some family that came to visit you, right?
Yeah, I have a couple families. One lives in Golden and the other one lives in Littleton. So right around Denver area, they came and hung out and kept me company while I was there.
All right, brother, be honest. So how bad are the Craig ramps?
I guess it depends. You know, it varies. They're definitely not easy. And they teach you really quick that when you get out into the real world, this is just the tip of the iceberg, so to speak. You know, there's so many other obstacles that come up when you're trying to navigate the real world that those ramps are definitely daunting when you're first injured, and they take you through they take you through wheelchair training and push you up, make you push up those ramps and go down them backwards and be able to do wheelies and go up and down curbs and all that kind of stuff. And they definitely push you, but they teach you to some resilience for the real world.
Yeah, we've heard some stories.
I still get aches thinking about some of those ramps. There was one in particular, they made me go backwards. It was like a slight incline, but it was just the cutest PT, and I was not going to let her down.
Yeah.
Now I know how to motivate you, Dad.
Yeah. I remember she's like, push, push, push. I'm like, my arms are dead. And I'm like, do whatever you tell me, ma'am. Good Lord. I just remembered that. That just, when you were talking about that, I just had that memory pop into my head. Because I was there during a different part. Like when I left, it was just going to start snowing.
Oh, really?
Well, the week before I left, that was the first snow in the city. And being from here, dude, we don't, like, that was snow. Like, we had that snow one time back in the day here. Remember that? Like the 1 in 100 year snow. And it was like the 2-inch blizzard, right? And for us, it's a blizzard. But like that day, oh my God, I went outside and I saw snow. I was like, dude, that's a different beast.
We don't know anything about snow.
Yeah, no, we don't. All right. So Craig Hospital, getting ready to go home now. What was your one of the biggest adjustment once you go home? What was the thing that you had to kind of adjust most to?
I mean, definitely not as much of an accessible environment, right? Like everything at our house was kind of hodgepodge together the best way we could. Thankfully, like we already had a room that was accessible because we had previously made modifications to our house for my grandmother. So we actually had a wheelchair accessible room, but the bathroom wasn't accessible. We live in an old farmhouse, so all the doorways are super narrow. It's, you know, a 3-level house, so there's a lot of stairs and stuff. So I'm pretty restricted within, you know, the floor I was on, but it still gave me that ability to be home, be around my friends, and kind of just have that time to settle in and, I guess, you know, process things kind of on my own time.
You know, I didn't ask you earlier, when you were leaving, did you come home with any equipment that you were going to need? Because I know Craig, sometimes they'll do their assessment for their wheelchairs and stuff there. Did you bring stuff home with you, or did you get some while you got home, like after you got home, as far as any of that equipment? How did that work for you?
I mean, Craig really took care of me. Because you're leaving the state and going to another state, sometimes there can be a lapse in trying to get scripts from doctors and get medical supplies and all of those kinds of things. So they did their ultimate best. So they set me up in a wheelchair, and Tylight is actually out of Denver. So the Tylight was able to rush my chair and made sure I had my chair before I was discharged out of the hospital. They sent me with all the extra medical supplies that I could have potentially needed in the meantime until I was able to establish care here in Michigan. And they also helped me contact the doctors and find the people that would take the insurance and all that kind of stuff as well.
Do you have a Tylight right now? Is that what you're rolling
yeah.
in?
Yeah. Yep.
Is it a rigid or folding?
I have a rigid.
So you got the Aero Z?
I have the Aero Z, but I have the titanium frame. So I believe it's the Aero T.
Nice, buddy.
Yeah.
Nice. That's light, huh?
Oh, hell yeah, dude. It's super light, super strong. That's why it was called Tylight, because they came out with a titanium frame. And they were acquired by Permobil. So now they have more resources to put out some good products. I'm a big fan of Tylight. I like Tylight. I use that. It's one of my top three that I use when I'm designing wheelchairs.
I've never had the pleasure of being in a tie. Only because I need to get locked in. And
I could pick one up.
Yeah, but would I be able to put a lock system so I can lock into my vehicle?
Brother, we know a couple of welders, man. We'll figure it out.
Well, so I have a wheelchair van. Some of the ramp comes out on the side. And when I was trying to decide whether I wanted a transfer seat or drive from the chair, they were actually, like, they can attach the driving bracket to your manual chair. I don't necessarily think it's a super common request, but it is something that they can do.
Yeah, because I drive out of my chair.
I don't think it's necessarily, from what I understand, the safest to drive from your chair. But, you know, if that's what it makes it easier, trying to transfer and stuff as a quad, I get is, you know, that's a pain. Even me transferring, I transfer so much, I'm getting sick of it.
Are you starting to get this is one thing that, do you get like pain in certain areas or like calluses in certain parts of your arm from the transfers all the time?
Oh yeah. I mean, I have calluses and ripped up parts all over my hand, but that's also part of wheelchair basketball too. You know, but as far as transferring goes, I've had shoulder issues for a while. So I really try and emphasize my posture and keeping my back strong, so my shoulders stay kind of grounded and rooted and don't roll too far forward. So I constantly am working on my shoulder stability throughout different parts of my life, just depending on where I feel weak at and stuff.
Is that something you do solo? You just kind of work out and keep your shoulders as strong as you can?
Yeah, I have a standing frame at home, so I have bands attached to it. So I'm always doing like my Y's, T's, and I's and trying to get my shoulders and back strong, and because I'm always sitting down. Everything's always rounded forwards, and it's really hard to kind of keep those muscles engaged. So whenever I get in the standing frame, I try and get them active.
Gotcha. What kind of cushion are you sitting on? And what kind of back do you have on your...
As of right now, I'm on a Rojo Hybrid for my seat cushion. I like a little more of the foam and the rigidity of the seat, but I'm sitting all the time, so that air helps. And then right now, I have like the J3 or the J2 backrest, which I really liked in the beginning, but it has metal, like the backrest is like a firm metal plate, and then it's just kind of like a thick foam pad over the top, and that foam pad breaks down after a while, and then kind of leaning onto that metal bracket can kind of get uncomfortable after a while. So yeah. I'm definitely into exploring some new backrest options, but I have been pretty satisfied with my Rojo. I had the Java in the beginning.
What do you think about that one?
Honestly, when I first got injured, I really liked the Java, but I think after a while, it kind of started to feel like I was sitting on a toilet seat all the time.
Well, that's what it is.
Yeah, and that just kind of really made it uncomfortable for me. So that's what kind of moved it away. The second I sat on more of a rigid seat cushion, it felt so much better to me. So once I switched, I haven't been back.
You're offloading all that pressure.
How? Explain to me how, because weather in Detroit is so much different than weather here. Here, we have, what, like 10 months of summer, essentially, and a weekend of cold weather, and that's really it. How is it getting around in a wheelchair in cold environments or snow?
What are
some of those challenges?
There you go. That's what I was going to ask.
I think it really just depends. I mean, the wheelchair vans, like, they're pretty heavy, so I feel like the front-wheel drive, heavy van, they get around on the road in the snow pretty well. But the biggest issue you run into is people can be parked in the spots, and then the snow will get pushed into the handicap spot or like those openings. And so I really have to kind of be picky and choosy. Like, I might have to just go to the gym and back. I might not be able to stop at the grocery store or do some things, because if the snow is fresh or it's still like continually coming down, those things won't be plowed yet. And if it's, you know, a few inches of fluff, I can get through it. But when it's that wet, heavy stuff, it gets stuck in my wheels. And when it's like the other day, it was 6 degrees. The rims on my chair get so cold in probably 30 seconds, all the heat gets sucked right out of the rims. So just getting to the store door sometimes can be a pain. So, I mean, you can wear gloves and all those kinds of things. So it's just taking the necessary precautions when you can, or, you know, is the juice worth the squeeze? You know, if you have enough groceries and you stay stocked up, you might not have to go out in the snowstorm. So it's just kind of picking and choosing your battles, I'd say. And knowing, like when I go to the gym, I know that they always have the spots plowed and they know people in chairs are coming through there. So there are certain businesses are much more mindful, you know, because they know the clients that they keep. But it's not like that everywhere. So you just have to be mindful on how well the roads are plowed and, you know, who's going to actually help out, or if I have someone to help me. You know, my mom runs with me sometimes, my girlfriend goes with me, but some people have to work sometimes and I don't always have help. So you got to figure it out.
Hey, how does the cold impact your spasms? Does that impact it at all?
Yeah, it lights my spasms up pretty much instantaneously. Like if I don't have my ankles covered or something and I go out into the cold, my leg will just like kick off my foot plate.
For me, it's opposite here. I can't do socks if I've got my shoes on, because it's just hot.
Really?
Yeah, I don't. It's rare that I wear socks. I couldn't imagine. Yeah, because here in just a, I mean, the other day we say we had a cold front. For you guys, it's probably just a regular day, but it dropped to like 48, or it was 48 in the morning.
They're going
to
be offended.
Yeah. And for us, it's cold, right? Yeah. But like that morning, like, you know, or that night, actually, it's always the evening where I just start spasming a little bit more at night. It's just because it's just getting, like, you know, it's getting cold and I don't sleep as much, right? But I can't imagine like 6 degree weather. Seriously? No, I'm not. No.
I don't think
I'm just
ever
staying at home.
Experienced 6 degree weather.
The coldest I've experienced, I think, is 18 degrees.
Wow.
That was an instant for a football tournament.
Wow. When you start when you step outside and you get an instant shiver down your spine, that's right. How you know it's in the teens. But when you step outside and within the first 3 to 5 minutes, your hands are numb, that's how you know you're in the single digits.
You've been able to kind of, you've done it long enough to where now you can kind of tell.
Yeah.
How about
especially with the rims? Like I'm not even kidding. When I say within 30 seconds, like all the heat's out and your rims turn into icicles.
Right.
When he said that in my head, I was thinking, that's why they offer plastic coated rims.
Yeah. I mean, it absorbs a lot. It makes it a little bit, because a cold steel, dude, that's, oh no. How does it affect pain wise? Like, I'm sure, you know, you get there home at first, you've got a lot of pain, right? I kind of had some weird pains initially. What kind of pain were you having? And then does the temperature affect that as well?
Yeah. I mean, I think I had the benefit that when I was coming home, it was breaking into spring. The weather was starting to change. So I didn't have to deal with a ton of cold days. I think I recognized early on the rain was definitely like, I didn't even have to look out the window to know it was raining. I just felt really? Like the pressure on my body. I don't know how else to explain it. There's just like a certain level of like pressure in my equilibrium. And I never had that kind of perception before. But now, no matter what, when I wake up and it's raining outside, I could tell you before I open the window.
Yeah. My parents, whenever a cold front's coming in, it's the weirdest thing. Like they can say, they'll tell them, I'm starting to get an ache here. I think we're going to get a cold front or something like that. Yeah. I think it might be a barometric trick pressure thing or something. I'm not sure. It's the weirdest thing. I can feel a little bit off too whenever there's a front coming in. It's just something's not right.
Really?
Yeah, it's just the weirdest thing.
Tyler, talk to us about RIM. Was it the Rehab Institute of Michigan? I think you were going there, what, 5 times a week for 2 to 3 years?
Yeah, so after I came back home, I started physical therapy right away. I was going to PT at RIM, the Rehab Institute of Michigan, downtown Detroit, 5 days a week. And they had me anywhere from doing e-stim to on the table, doing leg movements, stomach time, getting stretched out, doing 4-point, working with bands, just trying to build my shoulders up. Because like I said, I had shoulder issues even before I was injured. So it was just like shoulders are going to be a constant focus for me as I evolve through the chair. So that was one thing that we started tackling right away. So I was there 5 days a week doing that. And they have a downstairs, which is kind of more of the inpatient transferring to outpatient. And then once you're, you know, out of your pain cycle and are a little bit more able, they'll send you upstairs and they actually have a track. I did a ReWalk trial up there. So they have some cool opportunities and there's always different medical trials and things going on there at the hospital. So they do their best to get people connected.
How quickly after that did you start adaptive sports?
I took a full year. And then I think after that for first year, Craig recommended to take a year off, let your spine heal, your rod stabilize, all that kind of stuff. So I took that advisement. I didn't do anything for my first year. And then the following, it would have been my third or my second year, I started playing sled hockey and then wheelchair tennis.
Wow.
Those tennis players are,
I have
it's impressive.
Seen that, dude.
Yeah, at the Olympics.
Amazing.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Dude, hats off to you, buddy. You went from sled hockey to tennis.
That's no
man.
Joke, dude. The way you all move is crazy. I could, no way.
No?
No. I just can't. I can't push off that hard ticket.
And right now you're playing wheelchair basketball for the Detroit Pistons, you said? How does that work?
Yeah, the Detroit Wheelchair Pistons. So as far as our games and tournaments go, a lot of times these teams, they all collectively will just meet up at a venue for the weekend and sometimes they'll set it up tournament bracket style, but other times we'll just play like 5 games in a weekend and that will all go towards our like year-end standings. So everybody's all over the country and we'll meet up in Chicago or Indiana. Indiana has a super nice Paralympic facility, so they put on some really good tournaments down there, but it just depends on what teams are going to be entered and we compete in our region and we head out to nationals, and that changes this year. It's going to be in Louisiana.
And this is what, Division II basketball?
Yep, Division II.
And what's your experience playing on the nationals?
I've been to nationals 3 times now, and it's a super cool experience. My first season, we were actually seeded number 1 and ended up making it to the Final 4 at nationals, which was a super awesome experience for my rookie year. And you get to see all the cool Paralympians out there because all the D1 teams are there too. So you get to see these guys that are just elite level performers, and they're all just busting it out on the court like we are. And it's super cool.
Amazing.
I think people in wheelchairs that do sports are some of the most intense people I've ever met.
No,
they're intense.
Yeah.
I
can see that.
It's a different level. Like I get to play with some athletes and that were intense, you know, before, but in a wheelchair, I feel more of it. I don't know what it is. I just think it started at Craig when I used to watch the quad rugby team practice. I don't know if they were there when you were there, Tyler. Were they still practicing at the gym downstairs?
I think by the time I got there, they were not still practicing there, but they had mentioned it.
Yeah, it was the Harlequins that used to practice down there.
Really?
The shouting and the yelling that I heard, it was fun to see, and I wanted to get in one of those chairs so bad, but they just wouldn't let me.
Something we had talked about yesterday that pretty damn cool is the Battle Buddy 3 gun. Am I saying that right? Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah. So it's a nonprofit out of Florida, and they're called Battle Buddy 3 Gun. And so they do weekending events in different states. So I think they did Michigan, Florida a couple times. And then I think they hit a couple other states like Virginia and maybe Louisiana or something. And they do on Saturday, it's basically like a training day. They take you through all the shooting stages, the different weapons, make sure you're competent and able to shoot and operate the different things. And then the second day, it's full competition. So you go through 3-gun stage course. So you have your AR, your pistol, and your shotgun, and there's targets. And you actually have a battle buddy. So they put you in these specifically adapted chairs, and your battle buddy pushes you through the shooting course. So you get to, you all get the same 10 minutes before you all go shoot the course, and you walk out there with your battle buddy and you strategize and you say, okay, I'm putting this many shots here, and then we're going to transition this way. And so then it's up to you and your battle buddy to communicate and move through the shooting stages. And then whoever has the shortest time, and depending on if you have any misses or anything, adds on time as well. So we all competed, and it's all free as well. If you're an adapted shooter and you want to experience it, go check them out on Instagram. It's Battle Buddy 3 Gun. And every summer they put on a handful of clinics. You know, you might have to travel out there and pay for that stuff. But as far as the event and everything itself, that's all free, because they get a lot of special forces guys to donate, and they even donate their time, and those guys come out there. So when you're learning on Saturday, you're learning from special force veterans.
Those guys are beasts. I'm sure they can just tear it up. No problem.
Yeah.
I'm curious. I'd imagine mostly it's a paraplegic thing, but do you ever have any quads out there shooting as well?
Yeah, actually, man, I have a buddy that I grew up rodeoing with, and he ended up breaking his neck riding saddle bronc horses. But he's a quadriplegic, and he has all the modifications on his power chair. So he got one of those little Caltech fold-up guns, and he has it set up to where it stages on his power chair, and he just drove in his power chair, and they kind of had like a modified division for that, right? And nice. So they just kind of put him in a different division, and that way it's fair. So there was a guy who was more able, and he could use his leg and his arms and stuff with his manual chair. So he actually pushed through the course himself as well. So like it's however you want to do it, they're willing to work with you as long as it's safe and effective, right?
I was just curious, because I go hunting. I've always been a bird hunter since I was a kid. So shotguns mostly is my thing. But I was just, you know, I'd wondering like how I do it. And I've tried different things. Really cool. I'm sure there's some really cool adaptations that other quads have used to figure those things out. I've always kept it simple myself.
If you want to make it a thing and you want to go out there for it, I'll meet you in Florida, and they'll take care of you. They'll make sure you have a good time for sure.
Let's go, dude.
When do y'all, what part of the year do y'all do that?
It's in the summertime.
I mean, we have time.
And they don't always drop the schedule right away. So we could even reach out to them and say, hey, let us know. And, you know, that might even be a cool podcast to do. You might meet some cool people there.
Go to the website and check it out, because I'm just curious how they do that. Because, like I said, I've only ever shot a shotgun. I've always wanted to try it. Like, I shot my uncle's AR once just to try it. Well, that was cool. But
geez.
We're out there in the
Hey, let's give the quad an AR.
Yeah, but it was just one or two shots. I just wanted to try it, and you know, it was cool, but scary at the same time because it's, you know,
hell yeah,
I don't want to get a spasm and just right, like my fingers spasming.
The first thing that crossed my mind, Daniel.
Yeah, it's just one of those things where you just gotta.
I'd be running the other way.
Yeah,
you just keep it pointed downrange. That's all you gotta.
Yeah, just downrange. There's nobody over there. No, but it's you know, I went up. One of my good friends, he shoots rifles, and Andrew.
Oh yeah.
And shout out Andrew. I know he's coming out soon. One of my best friends. I know he's done some training with people where he did a mile shot with his rifle. Yeah. And you know, I've been, when he's down, I want to ask him, you know, how we could adapt a gun just so I can shoot the, you know, big long range rifle. That'd be fun for me to just try one of these days. Ooh. I might tear the hell out of my shoulder, but whatever.
If we position it right and we put some sandbags behind it.
Well, because when I shoot the shotgun, you know, I've got good technique with a shotgun, so I hold it right, and you know, my shoulder, it'll just have a little bruising on it, but a rifle, that'll, what is it called, the recoil on that bad boy, yeah, is gonna do some damage.
There's gotta be a way to do it though. They can, yeah, set it up. They can figure that stuff out.
What I mean,
you just gotta put some sandbags up so the sandbags take the brunt. As long as you can pull the trigger, let the sandbags take the hit. You know,
I mean, it's the whole thing, right? It's just being like innovative and trying to figure out ways to make it work.
Yeah, if there's a will, there's a way, right?
I hear,
yeah,
that.
I've tried different ways of doing the trigger. Like there was the sip and puff way where it did it for you, but I didn't like that one. Then I did this thing where I used to bite down, and it was like a bike chain, and it would pull the trigger for me. But there was always a delay for me, and I was continuously just missing the damn birds. So eventually, my dad just rigged this little bent piece of metal with a glove that we put on there, so I can just pull on the trigger myself, and that was probably the best way of doing it.
The birds are probably like, ah, that's Danny.
Yeah.
We're going to have to move.
I know. Such a good shot before. Now I can't hit a damn bird to save my life, but I have fun doing it anyway.
Hey, Tyler, yesterday you mentioned that the Battle Buddies have their own wheelchairs, correct?
Yeah. So it's, I'm trying to remember, a company came out with this. It's like a 3-wheelchair, and it's like bike tires. And then there's the Battle Buddy 3 gun company actually modified these tables. And so these tables will sit on your lap, so it holds your pistol and your extra magazines and everything, so you don't have to wear like a battle belt or anything. So they custom modified these, and then they took they have little push bars on the side, and they took those push bars off so that they're not in the way, and then your buddy pushes you. So they're custom for this event, and so that somebody can push you around, but you also, if you wanted to, you can push yourself as well.
Nice.
Yeah, being pushed around, that it's like a weird motion.
Yeah.
Anytime, do you ever, well, I don't think you would never need to get pushed around, but like one interesting thing that, I don't know if this happens with you, but when somebody does push you around, do you ever, or is it just me, do you ever experience kind of like a motion sickness by any chance?
Yeah, especially if I'm just kind of sitting there. I feel like, right? I'm just like floating.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Huh.
But
it's the weirdest thing. People ask me, do you need help? And they want to push the chair. And the main reason I say no is, well, one, I can do it myself, but like I get this weird kind of motion thing going on. It's the weirdest thing.
Wow. First time I hear about that, dude.
Yeah. When I got the new wheelchair with these little power assist things, the first day or two, I felt it. Because it was a different movement for me.
It's a lot of torque when you're taking off of those power assists.
Yeah. I'd imagine it's just something you have to kind of get used to.
So Tyler, tell us, man, what's going on today? What do you have going on in life, brother?
A little bit of everything. I'm an entrepreneur. I got a few irons in the fire. So playing wheelchair basketball, that's my main thing right now because it's the winter season. But I had my first paid speaking event a couple months ago. So that was a big level up for me. I'm pretty proud of that accomplishment. I was recently recognized and got Boom Athlete of the Year, which is
congratulations, cool
around here.
Hell,
thank you. Yeah, and the guy that interviewed me and did the video and everything, he's a record-holding Paralympian, so that's pretty cool to be able to meet him and spend some quality time with him at the award ceremony and everything. He's kind of like the chaperone person, so we got to spend a lot of time with him. He's a cool guy.
So you're a real-life badass, then?
Yeah, pretty much. One thing he told me, he's got these vending machines, but he's putting healthy food in them. I mean, who would have thought?
You know? Healthy food. What kind of healthy food are we talking about?
Yeah. So, man, when I was in the hospital and I was an athlete, all I wanted was a meat stick, right? Like some beef jerky or something. And back then at the hospital, they didn't even have beef jerky. Now they've stepped up their game a little bit and they're putting beef jerky in there. But back then I couldn't even get some protein. So when I got back to Michigan and I got established here a little bit, I really took that to heart. And I was like, okay, I'm going to start a healthy vending machine company. So like my main snacks, like I don't know if you've ever heard of chlorophyll water, but so it's just water. It's got chlorophyll. It's got some mint in it, some things like that. So it's just like a healthy alternative. There's still water in there as well. But then you got protein bars. I don't know if you've seen the Quest protein chips. So it's still, you know, not necessarily healthy, but at least it's a protein variant or a zero sugar option for people that are at least trying to pay attention to their macros a little bit.
Nice. That's a good idea. Yeah, because snacks, especially unhealthy snacks, just kind of have more bad for us, especially being in a wheelchair. We get that little belly quicker. I saw the Doritos and I said, I'm just going to go with some Doritos, but yeah. I'm bad. I'm the worst when it comes to snacking.
You want to know a fun fact?
Oh yeah, talk to me.
Okay. Your body can turn protein into carbs, but it cannot turn carbs into protein. So as long as you're consuming enough protein, your body will use that protein to heal and synthesize, and anything left over will get turned into carbs. But if you eat carbs, your body is filling up on a bunch of empty calories. Right? So that's where the bloating and inflammation comes from.
I don't remember the name of the pathway. I teach this and it's been a couple of months since we did that. But yeah, carbs can't go to protein. Protein's carbs. It all happens in the liver, if I remember correctly. But yeah, I love me some carbs. But yeah, you're right. There's a lot to be said about inflammation and disease and from carbs as well. Yeah. Especially the type of carbs you get. That's a whole talk right there.
We could do that later.
Yeah, I mean, diet for people in wheelchairs, especially spinal cord injuries, it's a big deal.
Good idea.
It's a very big
deal. That could be a whole podcast.
Yeah,
wow,
yeah.
I didn't think about that. I'm going to write that down.
I learned a lot of that when I used to teach the food science class. It's, it's a big topic and something we should approach.
Yeah, I'm writing it down. Tyler, is there anything else you want to share with us? We're going to wrap up the show. I know you want to plug some of your social media where people can find you, things you're doing. Joe, if you want to do the same, man, just go ahead and chime in. This is your time.
Yeah, I mean, the main thing, if you want to look me up on Instagram or really anywhere else, pretty much all my handles are tkeller7. So I post and do all most of my stuff through Instagram and Facebook, and that's where you can keep up with me. But I got a variety of stuff going on. I have speaking events. I do a little modeling here and there. I do some welding as well. So if you're interested, feel free to follow along. But I post as much as I can. I stay active with my wheelchair basketball stuff too. So I'm expanding and trying to grow in my careers as well. So stay tuned for more.
Yeah. Well, we got you. We'll be making sure people hear about you and push your social media for you on different episodes. That. All right, Joe, tell us a little bit about what's your gym that you have going on? What was the name of it?
So our facility is called Pride Athletics and Physical Therapy. We are a strength conditioning facility and physical therapy company based out of Canton, Michigan. So I kind of mentioned this in the past during this podcast. My specialty is not necessarily in neuro PT, but we have spent the last several months collaborating with a lot of really amazing neuro PTs in the area, and then we have been adding in a lot of adaptive training into our facilities. So I kind of oversee some of that, just kind of keeping a PT eye on the personal training and wellness side of things, just for feedback. But the whole goal is providing another avenue of wellness for everyone in all populations.
What's the address of this place? Where can they contact you? Where can they find you?
Yeah, so the address is 5536 Research Drive, Canton, Michigan. And the phone number.
There you go. Anybody local, look them up. Sounds like a pretty cool thing, man.
Go get your workout on.
You know what, Todd? I got one final question I'm going to ask you, all right? So if someone's listening today and sitting in a hospital bed or at a rehab gym or in their car wondering if life's over, what would you tell them from where you are now?
Honestly, I'd have to say, like, it's not over in the slightest. There's so many opportunities that my life would have never taken this turn had it not been for my injury. The speaking engagements, the modeling, the different things. Like, rodeo was my main thing. Being an athlete, being a welder, starting a business as far as welding goes, that was my main focus before I got injured. So all I can say is I tried to do my best to take this as a blessing in disguise and make it something for the better. And so all I can do is encourage anyone else out there that's struggling and whatever is do your best to find purpose in something and find purpose in what you're doing, because that is going to help bring you through to the other side and give you something to continuously look forward to. Because when you get caught in all the pain and all the struggle, it's easy to get sucked in and short-sighted on things. And there can be so much more on the horizon that you don't even know that's coming yet.
I love that. Thank you for that. Any guy thing?
No, that was great. Thank you so much, Tyler. That was a great story. Hopefully we talk again. See about this thing in Florida.
Dude, I just need to look it up. Check it out.
I got a gas card.
Gas card.
Dude, we'll just hop in the truck and let's go.
Yeah, hey, absolutely. Hey, even I think the wheelchair basketball nationals is in Louisiana. That's a little bit of closer trek for you guys. Maybe we can link up out there.
The one from the
we have one of our local guys that'll be competing.
One of our guests. He's
it's Jody Bennett.
Jody Bennett. Yeah, is it? He'll probably be there.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he's out of UT.
Oh no, we're talking about Sean.
Sean Simmons. Yeah, he's
at UT Arlington.
Arlington. Yeah, and they have their wheelchair basketball team there.
Yeah.
Sure, they might be there because he just traveled.
He's a badass.
Yeah.
All right. Well, keep it in the back of your minds. If you're interested, let me know.
Yeah, we'll for sure hit you up. All right. Well, Tyler and Joe, thank you again for joining us. And like I said, we'll do this again later on. And for everybody listening, thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Wheelchair Roundtable. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.